radio network and all the wonderful programming that you can get right here on Progressive Radio Network, PRN.FM. I know many of you listen live. You can also listen by calling in. In fact, Progressive Radio is one of the top call-in shows in the world, believe it or not, all of Progressive Radio Network. So those of you who are joining us by call-in line, by PRN.FM, and all the other archives and ways that you can listen to our show, thank you so much for joining in. So we have a lot of classes and workshops going on, oh my goodness, almost every single day. And many of them, in fact, are free. So you can go to naturalnurse.com and click on calendar, because that is the best way. Now, you can also sign up right on the front page at naturalnurse.com, bottom left-hand corner. Just put in your email, nothing else, and you'll get a newsletter. We're sending one out next week, and we send it out every now and then. We don't bombard you. But the classes we have coming up, one after another, herbal certification course, using herbs for yourself and your family. Then we have a free online class called The Scientific Validation of Botanical Medicine, with a special section, The Consciousness of Plants. That's happening on May 15th. And then we have our spring season Chinatown Herb Walk, and that's on May 20th, where we actually meet downtown in Chinatown. Then we have another class on Feeling the Consciousness of Plants, also an edible and medicinal herb walk at Restoration Farm, thyroid, adrenal, pituitary, the sacred trione online course, and herbal medicine making workshop. And we do that only twice a year in the New York area, then we do it in Florida. That'll be June 24th. Registrations are pouring in, and that's from 11 a.m. to 3 p.m., a full day of going out in the field, gathering edible and medicinal plants, and making them into medicine. Registration for all these classes is available just a click away at naturalnurse.com events, and many of them are free. So you can check that out, and we'd love to see you either online or in person. Either way is absolutely wonderful. And today we have a very interesting guest, and she is Georgia Pesaitis. She is a pharmacist and nutraceutical meets pharmaceutical integration expert. She earned her Doctor of Pharmacy degree from Massachusetts College of Pharmacy and Health Sciences, and is currently finishing an MBA from Quinnipiac University. She's a certified diabetes patient educator and certified pharmacist. She has an extensive experience working in cross-functional roles between business and medicine, and has held positions in marketing, regulatory, and medical affairs, specializing in various areas including oncology, ophthalmics, and cardiovascular health and wellness. And she is the owner and CEO of Healthy Solutions Pharmacy Consulting, and also is the Associate Director of ECP Marketing. Pesaitis is an innovator in creating communication strategies for pharmaceutical information, which she'll be sharing with us today, and wellness. And she's a certified member of the Academy of Managed Care Pharmacy and American Society of Health Systems Pharmacists. So thank you so much for joining us today, Georgia.
Thank you so much for having me.
Okay, you're coming in. Okay, I don't know if you're on a cell phone or if you're actually on a landline phone.
Can you hear me?
You said you're on a landline?
Yes.
Okay, it's not that clear. I don't know why. Perhaps don't be on speakerphone. Be on, you know, regular. That might help a little bit. Okay, today we're going to talk about virus infections, and in particular, the fact that many of these that we'll be talking about today actually can be transferred from one person to another. I guess people really know that. In fact, there's also lots of information about the fact that these microorganisms can also be transferred very often from pets as well as from human to human, and also from vectors. So what are some of the various ways that we might be prone to pick up a viral infection?
Yes, that's absolutely correct. We are spreading them actually just from contact with one another. We are spreading them through hugging and kissing, and that's really the big thing is that anything where you're exchanging saliva or droplets, you can exchange these viruses and even different types of bacteria. That's why I tell everybody it's super important to be vigilant, especially during the height of the cold and flu season, to be doing more of an air hug than an actual kiss, because the saliva can really spread the viruses.
Right. Well, what is the cold and flu season? Because now we're hitting May. Would you say that's the time that they're very prevalent?
So we are kind of at the end of the cold and flu season at this point. It ends usually around the end of May, and it starts usually around January. And we call it the height of the kissing season as well, because when January comes, it's the holidays. You know, you're seeing all your families and friends, and, you know, you're under the mistletoe for Christmas. And it starts usually around the December, January time and goes through May. And the CDC does still recommend, even, you know, early spring, which is April, May, that everybody still do get their flu shot, even though the end of the flu season is around the end of May.
Right, right. Now, I'm not a big user of flu shots. Never have been, never will be. My parents who are in their 90s have never had one. My children who are in their 40s, you know, we don't do that. We usually use herbs and vitamins, but, I'm fine if people do choose to use that. I think one of the big problems with the flu, as you know, in terms of the flu shot, is the fact that it has had a very poor record, especially in the last few years, of actually giving or showing a huge effect in terms of substantiating help about not getting it or even getting a lower degree of infection.
Yes, and it's been very controversial, the flu shot. And every year, you know, the makers of the flu shot, they gather together for kind of the flu congress, you could call it, and they try to predict which viruses are going to be kind of most prevalent throughout the year, and they design the flu shot to target those viruses. Unfortunately, this year, there wasn't that great of a decision-making from the flu strain that's actually the most prevalent. So unfortunately, the one that we've been seeing at an all-time high this year, and we're seeing a lot in the news, is people that are getting very sick and actually dying from it because of the fact that the flu shot does not cover that strain, but it does cover other strains. And a lot of people may never get the flu shot and will get the flu, and vice versa.
Yes, but when we use natural remedies, we have so much substantiation about the fact that there's certainly a higher level of sort of no problem in terms of reaction, as well as a really massive difference in both the how strong the flu might be, how often you might get it, how quickly you might get over it, and that's why we tend to use natural remedies, have them around. So many herbs like andrographis, echinacea, and various vitamins can be helpful. They're not necessarily a treatment, but they can increase your own immune system so that you can fight off these things. And, of course, also what you're talking about is so important in terms of lifestyle choices. And I really like how you point out that people don't know that they can catch things so quickly just by, you know, kissing and hugging your relatives when you see them when it's an event that everyone's at.
Yeah, and you make a great point in regards to boosting your immune system all year round. And that's really the key from kind of a nutraceuticals and herbal side of it, is taking these throughout the year can help boost your immune system. So when we do get to the height of the cold and flu season, you're ready to combat that, and your immune system's a little bit stronger than, you know, if you were not to take them, things like echinacea. And I tell everybody vitamin C and vitamin D and all of those extra vitamins that you could take throughout the year will help boost your immune system. So that way, when you do get to that part of the season, you're a little bit stronger and you could hopefully, you know, not end up getting the cold or the flu.
Yeah, that seems to be really well documented, too, when we look at various references. If we're talking about vitamin C, for one thing, taking a lot of vitamin C, I actually do with my clients on a rotating level, because One interesting study found that if a younger woman were to take very high levels of vitamin C, they found an interesting phenomena, which is that the babies would be born with a higher need, a higher low-level need, which I thought was really fascinating, in women who were taking a very high level of vitamin C during their entire pregnancy. So keeping it, you know, it's interesting because the RDA, of course, is very low. I believe it's about 60 milligrams a day. And that they look at, as you know, as a pharmacist, for the amount that would stop you from getting a deficiency disease rather than optimize your immune activity. So it's interesting to look at dosage and form. You know, I love food. I mean, one great thing to do is eat food every day that has some vitamin C. Because as we know, vitamin C is not made by our body, and it also doesn't seem to be stored too well in our body. So that was a great suggestion. Even when we look back at some of the older studies, we can really see that it was studied, the Common Cold. That was in the British Journal of Nutrition in 1992. So it certainly has been looked at. I love kiwis as a great source of vitamin C. Also, they're a grab-and-go food because I'm always on the road, and you can carry them as long as you don't sit on them and squish them, but they're easier to eat on the road if you just need a little plastic knife. You can easily chop them up, and I don't eat the skin, although I've seen people eat the skin. And then, of course, you know, your common vitamins. That vitamin C is found in oranges and citrus fruit and lemons. One way that I make a natural vitamin C is take lemons, take the peel, of course organic, let it completely dry till it's really dry and crinkly, and then chop it up in a little coffee grinder. And that is an excellent vitamin C. It's basically free because you bought the lemons anyway, and it combines the vitamin C with natural bioflavonoids. So that's a real good vitamin C tip.
I do all of those exact things that you were talking about, and you make a great point in taking it in from the food that we eat. And we can be a little bit more conscious in regards to what kind of foods are we taking in during the height of the cold and flu season to help us combat that. And even taking things in addition to vitamin C, like vitamin D or just a general multivitamin.
Well, what is the latest teaching on vitamin D? Because that seems to be in a state of flux. It's really interesting to note that even the Journal of Pediatrics has changed the minimum amount that children should take. And boy, it takes a lot of data to make them move on that.
Yes, and actually, vitamin D is one of those vitamins that is a water-soluble vitamin. It falls under that A, D, E, and K. So it is suggested that we do, and we can take an additional vitamin D in addition to a multivitamin.
And it's also important in terms of the kind of vitamin D. When you get tested by your physician, you may want to ask for a vitamin D level. They're all usually offering that now, even if they're a conventionally based physician. And you want to ask for a 25-hydroxy vitamin D. That's the test you want, not just a vitamin D serum level, because that will give you a better concept of how much vitamin D is actually available to get inside your cells, where it does confer a higher level of help in terms of immunity and other health issues, as Georgia has been mentioning. So that's great, Georgia. So what kinds of infections might be spread through these droplets that you were discussing in terms of any kind of saliva, even if you don't know that it's there? Are you there?
Hello, I'm here. I'm sorry. I think we might have got cut off for a second. I didn't hear any of the last things that you just said.
Okay, fine. That's fine, Georgia. What I was saying is, what are some of the viruses that you were talking about that could be spread from person to person?
Because I'm actually a cold sore sufferer, I talk about HSV-1. Because believe it or not, according to the World Health Organization, 2/3 of our world's population has HSV-1, which causes cold sores, or we, other people might know them as fever blisters. This virus is a very common virus, a lot more common than a lot of people would think. And this is when asked that spread from person to person through saliva or even through things like drinking glasses and like using forks or any kind of water bottles. And that's one of the viruses that I think people forget. Actually, even if you don't have it, you could be having viral threat. You can see the people by changing saliva. This is what the weather talk about during the season. Or where a lot of people get cold sore outbreaks or So that's what I always talk about. And then also regular cold. A lot of, I won't get it if I go, you know, too close to them or hug them or kiss them. But that's actually a misconception. You can absolutely still get the cold by kissing somebody or hugging them because they, you know.
Okay. Well, stand by. You know what we're going to do? We're going to take a little break a little bit early now, Georgia, and the engineer is going to try to get back in touch with you because you do not have a good connection. We really cannot hear you. So I'm not sure if you're, you know, what kind of landline you have there. But we'll take a little break, and we will be right back with more right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z.
On this edition of The Natural Medicine Chest, we'll discuss the ancient Chinese science and art of acupuncture.
Acupuncture is a 5,000-year-old medical procedure involving insertion and manipulation of needles into specific points on the body. It is often applied to relieve pain during surgery and for many other conditions.
Acupuncture needles have been found in China that are over 4,000 years old. The first needles were made of stone. Later, bronze, gold, or silver was used, and today they are usually made from steel. Acupuncture was developed around the theory of special meridian points on the body connected to the internal organs, and that vital energy, or qi, flows along these meridians. According to this theory, diseases are caused by interrupted energy flow, and the stimulation of these points restores normal energy circulation. There is some scientific evidence of the existence of the meridians as a separate circulatory system. Studies were done in the 1970s by a Dr. Kim from Korea, where he injected radioactive dyes into the traditional acupuncture points. He observed migration of the dyes along the exact predicted path of the meridians.
Okay. How acupuncture works remains uncertain, but both Western and Eastern scientific studies on rabbits have shown that the analgesic effects are not simply a matter of suggestion. After the discovery in 1975 of endorphins, natural pain inhibitors in the body, some neurophysiologists suggested that the needles may trigger the release of these substances. American and Chinese studies have confirmed that placing acupuncture needles in the brains of dogs raises the level of endorphins in the spinal fluid.
Acupuncture is used today in most hospitals in China and by many private practitioners in virtually every country in the world, including the United States. The primary use is for analgesia, although ulcers, hypertension, asthma, and other conditions have been documented to respond favorably to this treatment. Chinese surgeons prefer acupuncture to the use of drug-induced analgesia because they claim it does not disturb normal body physiology and therefore does not make the patient vulnerable to shock. Brain surgery is especially amenable to this form of analgesia when it is necessary to keep the patient awake during the operation.
Although some modifications in the practice of acupuncture have been made, such as sometimes using a small electric current on the needle instead of the traditional twirling, acupuncture remains intact as an ancient therapeutic technique that has been used successfully for at least 5,000 years. Perhaps you'd like to add this piece of knowledge to your natural medicine chest.
have you on board with us, and we love getting you information, and we love seeing you either in person by joining in on many of our on-ground workshops and lectures, or online where you can get credit if you are a nurse, a registered dietitian, a massage therapist, or an acupuncturist. Our classes are CE certified for ongoing study. So you may want to check that out at naturalnurse.com calendar, which lists many of the upcoming classes. Okay, we believe we have Georgia Pesaitis back on. She is a pharmacist and specialist in the nutraceutical meets pharmaceutical. That's a great word. So thank you so much for joining us today.
It's such a pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
You sound about 1,000 times better. So this is great. Now, we were just talking about herpes, because you were saying that that's something that you personally, but certainly, you know, not pointing out you, because how widespread is having HSV-1?
And that's exactly a great point, is that HSV-1 is actually a lot more common than you would think. According to the stats from the World Health Organization, 2/3 of our world's population. So we're talking about billions of people, millions of people have it across the world. And actually, believe it or not, a lot of people think, oh, women have it more than men. It's actually pretty evenly split across men and women. So it is very common, and it is something that I tell people to just be a little bit more vigilant if you do see somebody with a cold sore, which is usually those blisters around the, you know, mouth area, the chin, or around the nose.
Yes, and now if you had it just once, does that mean that you have it in your body?
Yes, that is correct. So once you are exposed to the HSV-1 virus, you have it for life. It lives dormant within your nerve, and it can reactivate at any time. And there's a lot of triggers that are associated with activating the HSV-1 virus, like excessive exposure to light, excessive stress. Some people get it from different types of chemicals or preservatives in food. So it is one of those viruses that is, once you get it, you have it forever, unlike the cold or the flu, which may come and go as you're exposed. HSV-1, once you're exposed, you have it for life. And you might get an outbreak, and you might never get an outbreak. It just depends.
Well, how catching is it to someone else? Let's say through kissing or even sexual contact. If you had it once, but you never had another outbreak, is that still something that you would be transferring to someone else, or is it only during an active outbreak?
So when you have an active outbreak, that is when the virus is most easily spread from person to person. So when you do see somebody having an actual outbreak, which is those actual blisters around the mouth area, that is when it is the most contagious per se. Now, there is something called viral shedding, that during certain phases of the virus that you are still shedding it. But for example, if somebody has gotten one outbreak and then, you know, years down the line has never gotten another one, the chances of you having viral shedding is significantly low. But there is a phase that you could potentially be, you know, shedding the virus, even though you don't necessarily have an active blister. But if you are kind of 5 years down the line and have never had an outbreak, your chances of spreading it are pretty low.
Okay, so that's good to know. So even though you would still test positive, probably, if they did a test to see if you have the antibodies.
Yes, because it will live dormant within the nerve, and some people unfortunately get outbreaks all the time, and some don't at all. It just really depends on the individual and the triggers that cause that virus to rear its head.
So that's the thing, that at least we know that, you know, it's not if we had this outbreak once and had a cold sore once years ago, it doesn't mean everybody that you come in contact with is going to be affected by it.
Correct.
And
yes,
there's lots of things.
Yeah,
go ahead. Correct. So can we hear you still?
Yes, I'm here. Yes, you're 100% correct. We definitely don't want to scare anybody out there that if you had one time and now you're years down the line that you could potentially be giving it to somebody else. It's more of a situation if you have an active one and then for a period of time you are shedding that virus.
Okay. Now, What are some of the treatment options? Because I will definitely, I have seen them like disappear, and people do not suffer with it anymore when we initiate a natural, especially preventative therapeutics. What other treatments are available for herpes HSV-1?
You did say something that makes a great point. It's preventative and stopping kind of the recurrence, or at least trying to decrease the recurrence. There are a lot of natural options. Lysine is a great natural option that you can take over the counter. It's an amino acid. And some of the data does support that it helps with the recurrence, so not getting as many as you would per year. But a lot of with cold sores, a lot of it is treating those symptoms, that itching, that burning sensation. I use Abio myself, and I've worked with Abio, and they have a product that is a cold sore treatment gel, and you can actually put the gel right on the active cold sore, and it really decreases the symptoms, that itching, burning sensation. It does contain lidocaine and aloe vera, so really keeping it moist and putting something on it to stop that scratching feeling that a lot of cold sore sufferers out there know what I'm talking about. You get the scratchy sensation, and you really want to feel like you want to just itch at it. But the worst thing to do is touch it. You can definitely spread it. If you get it on your hands, you could potentially be spreading it to others as well as to yourself, to other parts of your body. So it's really important not to touch it. But the most important thing is to keep it moisturized in something like an Abio cold sore treatment gel, or just a general moisturizing gel or treatment, or just plain aloe. To keep it moist is really important. That really helps the healing process.
So, that's a good thing to have around. So you said it has lidocaine in it. Now, there's a lot of herbs that can be helpful also, such as something called sweet melissa, which is also lemon balm. And both using that topically as well as internally. And I've seen creams, like you said, lysine can be effective internally. Certainly see that work very well, but also can be used externally. So there's many, many natural things. Now, like you said, the lidocaine, that's not really going to be an antiviral, but it can certainly take down the swelling and the itching and the pain, and that's important too while you're waiting for it to go away. Another thing that I've given many, many clients is to use ice immediately. If they're one of those people that are prone to get in an outbreak, and we can talk about some of the things that might initiate an outbreak, but we know that stress does, and sometimes being in the sun can initiate an outbreak. But we find that if people, the minute that they know they're getting it, take lysine, of course, like you said, and also put ice on the area. Many people have found that you just don't even get the outbreak. You just can stop it, as well as using various creams and antivirals. So what do you think of those kinds of interventions?
So, ice, I really think does, get rid of that kind of like itching and burning sensation, because you're kind of numbing the area. And a lot of patients I know have also used ice in the past. It definitely helps that kind of, that initial, if you feel that initial stinging, you put it on there and it really alleviates that. But there are a lot of great, like you said, organic, natural options. One of them is also monolayer, and it's another herbal option that you can use. But what I really tell people is super important throughout the year is to be boosting your immune system. So that way you can combat it the same way that you do with the cold and flu. Because the second your immune system is suppressed, this is when you have the opportunity for the HSV-1 virus to rear its head and give you the full-blown cold sore. So again, like the other options we discussed earlier, like taking vitamin C, a great multivitamin, and even adding on different types of antioxidant vitamins like vitamin E and A, and even adding on vitamin D can really help boost your overall immune system. So that way you could hopefully combat the season when you do get a suppressed immune system.
Yeah, that's a very good idea, as well as, of course, eating really healthy. Now, you did mention something, Georgia, that I love, which is monolaurin, and that's actually lauric acid. Monolaurin is one brand of it. I have seen that really, really help with various viral infections, including something like Epstein-Barr.
Agreed. I actually suggested to a lot of our middle schoolers and high schoolers who get what we call the kissing disease, or what we call mono, And mono is actually caused by the Epstein-Barr virus and a lot of younger kids who are, you know, exchanging a lot of kisses could potentially still get mono. And even you coming home to your parents, you could potentially contage them with mono. And I've seen monolaryn is one of those that works really well in patients with mono.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about mono because that's an interesting name. People know that, and I think it's linked to something that's even more widely known, which is called chronic fatigue syndrome. And we know that that's linked to several viruses, including what we would call mononucleosis, but also that's kind of the condition because it might be Epstein-Barr virus, it might be cytomegalovirus, various viruses can initiate this. But it is known as the kissing disease, which, you know, goes way back in time when they first were isolating this problem. And, of course, when we look at mono, we're also looking at various white blood cells, which are called monocytes. And the body often will release monocytes when we see monocytes in the dark field microscope. I often use that letting people know at an educational level, put a drop of blood on the microscope, and we can clearly see the various kinds of white blood cells that exist there. We might have neutrophils, which move around a little bit more with phagocytosis, the way they gobble up, invading particles that shouldn't be there. But when we see a lot of monocytes, which look quite a bit different, very often that relates to an elevated viral titer. And that's another good blood test that people can get. Both look at if their monocytes are elevated and also the viral titer that can be measured to try to track down what's wrong with them. They're usually going to feel not so good. How would you say people feel when they have mono?
Yes, mono provides these symptoms, which a lot of individuals confuse them. Maybe they think they have the flu or the cold. But one thing that really sticks out is what you mentioned, which is this chronic fatigue. And they almost can't seem to get out of bed. It's exhausting, and you're really tired for a long period of time. And that really is kind of indicative of having mono, is that really that chronic fatigue, the exhaustion. And, you know, it could be accompanied with a fever. You could have even kind of if you have very severe and even have further complications like an enlarged spleen, different viruses like the Epstein-Barr virus could potentially cause even more complications like an enlarged spleen. That's why I tell everybody if you seem to not be able to knock it after, you know, that 14-day period of time, I would go see a physician because you want to make sure that you're, number one, not dehydrated, but also, two, that you don't have any further complications from the virus.
That's true. Very true. So that's important. Now, a lot of people feel pretty ill for quite a while. When they have chronic fatigue, they're often, that. How is it that that can go on at times, you know, literally for years?
Yes, and this is one of those viruses that lives within you. And individuals who get this, what we call true chronic fatigue syndrome, and not necessarily what we think of as the acute, you know, virus, or what we think of as what we call as mono, is really hard to combat. And it's really important. I tell everybody, if you do have this, if you've been diagnosed with chronic fatigue syndrome, it's super important to start focusing not only on the pharmaceuticals that you're taking, which there are a lot of prescription options that physicians may give you, even things along the lines of steroids, but from a nutraceuticals and herbal supplement standpoint, is to load up on those as well, because that will really help you kind of with that fatigue feeling, and really helping boost your immune system. And even taking things, I know we've discussed multivitamins and different types of vitamins, taking things like echinacea, but also taking something like a probiotic to help really kind of normalize your natural flora and really help kind of combat that fatigue that you're feeling.
Yeah, and it really, it's a frustrating thing because people will sometimes, we find not so much pharmacists, but physicians will often just put them on antidepressants after a while. Now, it is depressing if you have a long-term chronic fatigue situation because you don't feel well, but going on antidepressants often makes them actually much worse.
Absolutely, because the issue that you're having is not with your true serotonin levels or a chemical imbalance that you might be having. It really is something else. And so I agree with you 100%. And I'm the type of pharmacist that I don't like unnecessary prescriptions. I think that there are a lot of complements to pharmaceuticals with nutraceuticals. And I think to optimize your overall health, it's not necessarily taking one or the other, but really kind of focusing on the patient as an individual and seeing, okay, what are we focusing on? What do we need to treat? And then what can we supplement with nutraceuticals and herbal supplements to really help optimize that patient's health? So I agree with you, unnecessary antidepressants, which I think we do a lot in our society for a lot, a variety of different things, is something that needs to be evaluated a little bit closer, I think, from a psychiatrist or a psychologist before, you know, you just give them a prescription for antidepressants for chronic fatigue syndrome.
Well, yeah, that's, you know, I think it's the wrong track, actually, because then they often have adverse effects to the antidepressants, and in the end, they're feeling worse than better. So perhaps physicians need more education from people like you who understand what this phenomena is about and looking at it as an overall degradation of the immune system, which can be built up, and also looking at things like food allergies. It becomes a very complex picture rather than that something about just killing a microorganism.
Yes, I 100% agree with you on that, and I'm a big supporter, and, you know, I speak to a lot of physicians in regards to the pharmacology of a lot of medications. And, you know, it's not a one-size-fits-all, especially with antidepressants. I tell them to really, really make sure before you start prescribing that it's the proper prescription and this patient actually is suffering from a true diagnosis of depression and not necessarily something like, you know, a chronic fatigue syndrome or situational depression or, you know, different things that could potentially be unnecessarily prescribing antidepressants.
Yeah, that's a very good thing, because I think in general the way conventional medicine is practiced is not really what I would consider prudent, evidence-based. Because what I really like to promote, and I've been doing this since 1964, is the use of medications, which are often exactly perfect for what we need. But we need to review the healing effects in relation to the adverse event profile and the cost. We can put the cost in now too, right? And when we look at natural remedies, although they certainly are not all safe all the time, and we do need to be careful when people are on pharmaceutical drugs because there are herb-drug interactions, which seems to be shouted out by conventional physicians. However, they don't seem to pay much attention at the same time with drug-drug interactions. I find that pharmacists are most well-schooled in that, and good pharmacists, especially when they have the same clients and customers coming in, they will actually check that and make sure, especially if you're seeing one doctor for one med and another doctor for another med, they don't seem to pay much attention to the drug-drug interactions.
That's a great point. And that's why I tell everybody, you know, having a relationship with either your local pharmacist that you're, you know, your independent pharmacy, or even if you're going to a CVS or a Walgreens, most of the pharmacists are very well-versed, and now we also have really high-tech computer systems where they can put in everything that you're taking, including nutraceutical options, and making sure that whatever you are taking from a pharmaceutical standpoint and a nutraceutical standpoint is somewhat complementary and not having any contraindications or drug-drug interactions.
Right, and there's almost no way, because everything does interact with each other. But, you know, sometimes it's not something that's terrible. And sometimes that drug-drug interaction or adverse effect caused by a pharmaceutical is what you wind up taking the next pharmaceutical for. Like, you're taking something for indigestion, but that causes headaches. So then you're going to be taking something for headaches, and that causes joint pain. So in other words, it seems to lead to polypharmacy.
Yes, and you make a great point. It's polypharmacy. And I think a lot of what we try to do, and I think what physicians try to do and pharmacists try to do, is we weigh the risk versus the benefit. And we really want to make sure that, you know, these AEs, which all medications come with them, even, you know, some natural options and pharmaceutical options come with these AEs, especially if you're not dosing them properly. But what I think the goal is to really ensure that the risk, the benefit is outweighing that risk of these additional AEs that you are going to take on, these adverse events like a headache, like nausea, And is it worth it for that patient? And I think that's why it's so important to look at every patient individually versus just kind of throwing the kitchen sink at them and wishing them the best and telling them to go to the pharmacy and ask your pharmacist about it. I think it's important from the beginning to start and look at it from a holistic approach.
Yes, that's an excellent point, and I agree. Now, about you do so many different kinds of work. What is the Academy of Managed Care Pharmacy about and the American Society of Health Systems Pharmacists?
Yes, so the managed care pharmacy is really focused on formulary coverage for patients through managed care. So managed care, you know, I think today in today's society, we know, and you brought it up, is cost, and it runs our world. And what we can get at the pharmacy is not necessarily the pharmacist making the decision. It's your managed care plan. And really, they're the ones controlling the costs of medications through their pharmacy benefit managers, which now a lot of the pharmacies are owning pharmacy benefit managers, which are then owning managed care. So it's starting to get very convoluted in this kind of managed care space. But really, their goal is to look at formulary coverages and ensure that patients are able to get their medications at a decent cost, especially those who have Medicare and Medicaid.
Yeah, so when we're talking about costs, and if we look at other country models where care seems to be more state-supported and they seem to have a better handle on cost because there's less conflict in terms of profit management, they very often will find that the best, most cost-effective, safest, lowest adverse effect profile is to use herbal remedies first.
And I think a lot of individuals are trying, you know, what we consider, you know, herbal or nutraceuticals as much as they possibly can before they go to pharmaceuticals because of the rising costs. And so a lot of
people
are...
Well, let me say this. I think you're right when you say individuals. One of my life goals, just in terms of, you know, future knowledge about something else we may be able to work towards in a larger sense, you're right that many individuals do. That's why we're so busy. That's why the natural product industry is one of the fastest growing industries in the United States. That's why there were 70,000 participants at the last Natural Products Expo in Anaheim. But what I'm saying is my goal is to bring that knowledge into mainstream so it becomes not just an individual trying it, but standard of care, because it is more efficacious, it is more cost-effective, and it's safer for the patient.
Yes, and I think that the way that physicians are going to start utilizing that is understanding where the data comes from, because a lot of physicians really like to focus on what you said before, which is that evidence-based medicine. And there are a lot of studies out there for different types of herbal supplements that I think just needs to be built up from an educational standpoint for them to understand the data. And I think when they understand the data, then they'll feel more comfortable with it. I think where the deficiency is mainstream CEs and programs don't necessarily incorporate that kind of data into these kind of, let's say, these bigger CE events that most physicians go to get their yearly credits. There's definitely a deficiency in explaining nutraceuticals and herbal supplements. And I think if there was just more education for these physicians, or at least brought into kind of the mainstream versus, you know, them individually having to go seek it out, because I agree with you. I think there's definitely a need. And unfortunately, I just don't think physicians are quite comfortable with the data in order to start really pushing it as their first line, or at least trying it before they jump to a pharmaceutical product, which they may know more about for a variety of different reasons.
Well, that's a great analysis. Well, we're going to take another little break right here. When we come back, we're going to continue our discussion with Georgia Pasetis, and she is a pharmacist and has lots of interest in the nutraceutical meets pharmaceutical and integrating that knowledge together. If you want to find Georgia, you can find her, I guess that's a Twitter, G Pasetis RX. We will be right back with more right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, the founder of the Progressive Radio Network. Today, we have more than 80 producers bringing forth the most progressive and most liberating information. the kind of information you do not regularly hear on any of the mainstream or alternative media. You can help us now. Up to this point, I have virtually supported the Progressive Radio Network, all of its expenses and payroll, myself. But we would like to expand our reach. We'd like to do far more. We'd like to be able to advertise on Facebook and let others know we exist. We are the number one Progressive Radio Network in the world. In fact, we have programs that are most listened to in all of Progressive Radio. But we could go a lot further. Our message could reach a lot more people, especially at a time when people are desperate for honest, objective insights on the important topical issues of our day. How can you help? It's simple. Go to prn.fm, go to our main page. In the upper right-hand corner, you'll see a little button, Support Now. And then whatever you can contribute on a monthly basis will make a big difference. It will help get the message out. It will help inform more people, will give them more choices. This is where you'll hear Jill Stein and Ralph Nader and the independent candidates and the people looking to challenge the corruption in government and industries. But we need to get our reach out further. So please, whatever you can afford on a monthly basis, and there's some suggestions there, and it'll be automatic. All right, thank you very much for continuing to help us help you and the rest of the world on these important issues.
And Dr. Z. And we are here today. You can always get in touch with us at naturalnurse.com. You can check out all our classes at naturalnurse.com. Across the top, go to calendar. Or you can visit any of our radio shows or other radio shows done on Progressive Radio Network, because all of them are archived. Our guest today is Georgia Pesaitis, PharmD, and she is a pharmacist as well as a nutraceutical expert. So let's talk about that, Georgia. As you said, many people involved in conventional medicine, and that includes pharmacists as well as physicians, have not been well trained in even considering natural interventions. How is it that you have learned so much about this kind of information?
So throughout my career and kind of even my education in pharmacy school, I started gaining interest in it because I started reading just kind of, data here and there in regards to kind of our most common things that we hear about, like echinacea and different types of things like monoaron. And because I was a cold sore sufferer, I found those things really interesting. So I started looking into it myself. And I started realizing that there's all these certification programs and CEs and things that you can do specifically with herbals and multivitamins and, just vitamins and nutraceuticals in general. And I started educating myself and really taking it upon myself to find out how can I implement these into kind of mainstream pharmaceutical prescribing and adding on complementary nutraceuticals and herbals to optimize health, or even starting there and then going to pharmaceutical if that's not working. And I really took it upon myself to get certified and go into different programs to learn about it, because it's really not in mainstream, pharmacy education, medical education, unless you take it upon yourself to take extra courses and credits in order to learn about it.
Yes. Thank you so much. That's true. That's absolutely true. And we're so fortunate to have someone like yourself who has taken the time, the energy, and the expense to become educated in this area. So what I'm saying is, why isn't it Now, to me, it seems political, and in terms of the fact that should more physicians move in this direction, that's actually a threat in terms of economics to the pharmaceutical companies, who must think so also, because at this very moment, they're actively buying up the nutraceutical companies. So they must think that this is writing on the wall of where things are going.
And I think it's twofold. I think they see that there is a great need and a great demand for nutraceuticals and herbal supplements in our industry today. And they see that need and that demand building up because, like you said, a lot of people individually are going out and seeking out these options. And without their, let's say, physician's, you know, permission or, you know, suggestion, they're going out and looking at it themselves. And I think what companies are seeing is that build up in that demand. And we all know demand brings, along with demand brings money. So I think they're noticing, okay, this is a lucrative industry and we need to get in it. But I think from a pharmaceutical standpoint, and I speak from the standpoint, one, because I'm in it, and I do work for a pharmaceutical company, as well as working for other companies that are for nutraceuticals and herbal supplements. I think physicians do want to do the best thing for their patients. I really, really do, and I want to believe that in my heart. And, you know, yes, do they have agreements with pharmaceutical companies? Absolutely. That's how they do get, you know, medications to their patients. But I really do think they want to do the best thing. I just think that there's a need for more education. I really do. I think they're just undereducated on how efficacious and how this data actually has presented itself over the years. And you brought up a great journal from the British Medical Journal, which was a great study done in the 90s. And I think there's even more recent data. They just don't know about it. I mean, I ask my friends, even my colleagues who are pharmacists, and they're like, no, there's no data on that. What are you talking about? I've never read anything about, you know, that vitamin or that herb. And I'm like, well, actually, there is data that exists, and this is where it is, and this is what it says. So I really think it's a lack of education. I think that individuals like yourself and I are doing a great job of going out there and really trying to educate people on the benefits of herbal supplements and nutraceuticals.
Right, and I tell so many of my physician and pharmacist and nursing friends, just go to PubMed and register yourself to get every update on herbs and vitamins. Every single day, your inbox will be flooded. And a lot of it is in mainstream medical journals, like the Journal of Rheumatology, the Journal of Gastroenterology. I mean, this is not obscure, and this is not old. It's today. We're talking 2018, and every single year. So also, of course, pharmacists were always herbalists. Until very recently ago. So the fact that all that knowledge has been expunged from pharmacy education, I think, is diabolical and also has not necessarily happened in other countries.
Yes, and I think they incorporate it to some degree, but definitely by no means is anybody an expert when they graduate from pharmacy school. Are they an expert in pharmaceuticals? Absolutely. I think pharmacology and medicinal chemistry is focused on the pharmaceutical component, but definitely not to the extent that's needed for the kind of nutraceutical herbal supplement component, because there's so many different options, and they all have different types of effects, and there's all different types of data. And I think unless you take it upon yourself, it's definitely not explained very well the way that it would be for pharmaceuticals in that kind of pharmacology component.
Right. But it's very recent, however, because if we just go back a couple of decades, not that far back in time, you look like a pretty young person. But like I said, I've been doing this since 1964. And even in the 1950s, most of the pharmacology books were full of herbs. That's what was taught, because that's what they were. So pharmacists, not going too far back in time, you know, Park Davis was one of the main providers of herbal medicines, but they were called drugs.
Yes, yes. And you know, I think there are some courses here and there that get trickled in that bring that concept up. And it's definitely something that I agree with you. I think it needs to come back to that and consider it and at least be a resource for your patients. If the physician's not necessarily doing it, you know, for you to be a resource for your patients and let them know that there are other options that they can try. Or at least take in addition to other things that they're taking.
Yeah, and I really honor that pharmacists will always actively tell patients more about possible herb-drug interactions. You know, if they decide, let's take ginkgo when they're on Coumadin already, that might not be a good idea, especially if you're going to have your tooth pulled or something where you might get excessive bleeding. And pharmacists will often be the one to point that out.
Yes, and that's one thing that I really focused on when I first kind of started my career, was focusing on drug-drug interactions and focusing on which ones, from an herbal and pharmaceutical standpoint, do have those issues. Because a lot of individuals don't know, and unless it's kind of put into the pharmacy system and it pops up an alert and it tells you, you know, a lot of people might not know that. So you bring up a great point that there are certain types of nutraceuticals that you can't necessarily take with pharmaceuticals. And I think making sure you have a great pharmacist that you're working with, either an independent pharmacy or your pharmacy, to just give you that kind of feedback and let them know what you're taking from a herbal and nutraceutical standpoint. A lot of the times, it's not in the system because people do go and buy them over the counter, or they go to their kind of, you know, there's a lot of new herbal stores that open up, and pharmacists don't know what you're on unless you tell them. If you go and buy it somewhere else, it's not necessarily in your profile.
Yeah, with the advent of electronic medicine, which I have, you know, it's kind of a double-edged sword like everything else, but wouldn't it be wonderful if we are able to have a system where everybody's data is in one place, so every doctor will know what things they are already taking to avoid even, you know, drug-drug as well as herb-drug interactions?
Oh, absolutely. And if you and I want to collaborate and start that system, I think we'll become, we can retire early, and we'll be able to definitely help, I think, all of the patients that really, I think, would benefit from a system like that.
It is important because I actually know people who passed away, literally, because they went from one doctor to another about a particular health, and they had like 15 different drugs they were taking, and then she got dizzy. Of course, you as a pharmacist would know she would have, and hit her head on the bed and died. So I actually feel like it was linked to the over-prescribing, and because one doctor didn't know what the other doctor was doing, which is her fault also. I mean, but for the patient to have to keep track of all that isn't always going to happen either. So we are at the end of our time. Wonderful show. Thank you so much, Georgia. And I know that, you know, whatever personal challenges you're having today, I heard about it through the grapevine there. But I really love that you came on anyway. Thank you so much. And how can people best find you?
I would love to hear if anybody has any additional questions. You can always reach me on Twitter or on Instagram at GPasadasRx. But you can also email me to my consumer inbox at healthysolutionsrxconsulting@gmail.com.
Very good. And we'll have that posted. And until next time, this is Ellen Kamai wishing you the best.